morning. Well, this next panel is on disarmament, demobilization, reintegration, and rehabilitation, DDRR. And our panelists will discuss the process and the scope of DDRR, the challenges it faces, and the roles that are played by various stakeholders, such as the community, service providers, and others, and donors. So we will start first with Anne McComey, who is the child protection focal point at DPKO at the UN. And then we will next move to Teresa Betancourt, who is the Director of Research Programs at the François Xavier Bagnoud Center, and also Assistant Professor of Child Health and Human Rights at Harvard's Public Health School of Public Health. And then finally, we'll hear from Bernard Harborne, who is the lead conflict advisor on Africa at the World Bank. And we'll wrap it up with our discussant, John Williamson, who's the senior technical advisor for the Displaced Children and Orphans Fund at USAID. So with that, I will just turn it over to Anne McComey, who will get us started, and I'll move on from there. Thanks.
Thank you. My name is Anne McComey. I'm with the Department of Peacekeeping Operations, DPKO. I'm the focal point for child protection. And my presentation will basically frame the children's issues in the broad DDR context. I will provide the UN definition of DDRR, and then I will look at some of the distinctive aspects of children's DDR from what is understood as broad DDR or formal DDR of adults. And then finally, we'll look at what DPKO is doing, what our engagement is, our contribution, and what we think is the way forward. The common definition of DDRR adopted by the UN is contained in what is referred to as the IDDRS standards, the Integrated Disarmament, Demobilization, and Reintegration Standards. And these were developed between 2004 and 2006, and they have it's a whole repository of best practices that have been drawn from the experience of the United Nations, departments, agencies, and all programs that are engaged in DDR activities. And DDR is defined as a process that contributes to the security and stability in a post-conflict recovery. It has three stages. The first is the removal of weapons from combatants. The second, it's taking the combatants out of the military structures. And the third is helping them to integrate socially and economically into society by finding civilian livelihoods. And the breakdown, I will not go too much into the technicals of technicality of it, but there's a breakdown of all these elements that was provided by the Secretary General. The first is disarmament, and that is the collection, documentation, control, and disposal of all weapons. And the emphasis is that these weapons are taken away from combatants. This is in the adult DDR process. The demobilization is referred to as the formal and controlled discharge of active combatants from armed groups. Then we have reinsertion, which is the third stage, and it's a temporary assistance that is given to the ex-combatants once they've been removed from armed groups as they wait for the reintegration. And finally, reintegration is seen as a long-term process by which these people are helped to reintegrate into civilian life. When it comes to children's DDR, however, there is a difference, and that is why I've tried to break down all this for you. And I will now try to highlight some of the differences between what is known as the formal DDR, RR, and the DDR of children. Parallel with this whole learning that has been happening on adult DDR process, a lot of practice and policy has emerged on DDRR of children. And these are contained in certain policy documents. I will just highlight three of these. We have the Cape Town Principles of 1997, which basically made recommendations for actions to be taken for the release of children to end the recruitment of child soldiers. The IDDRS also have a very complete and detailed manual on the principles of DDR of children. And then we have the Paris Commitments and Principles, which were adopted in 2007, and although and have been endorsed by a couple of states, I think 66 states so far. The first bit of it, the commitments, are actually just a restatement of international standards for DDR of children and international law on the recruitment and use of child soldiers. And then the guidelines and all the principles are very, very detailed in terms of what programs should be implemented and how those programs should be implemented. This endorsement of these principles, by the growing endorsement of these principles, is giving leverage to actors in the field, child protection actors, to push for release of children unconditionally and also for a certain set of practices when it comes to their reintegration into their communities. So without going into the details of programming, I will look very briefly at some of the distinctive aspects of children's DDR. And that's what distinguishes them from the formal DDR of adults. Whereas the objective of the broad and formal DDR process, as we've seen, is to contribute to security and stability in post-conflict environments, DDR of children is premised on the imperative of securing children's rights. So because the recruitment of children is illegal in international law, their release or demobilization, and the preferred word is really release, is not contingent upon any political negotiation. It is a human rights issue. Therefore, the release of children is sought at all times. It should be sought unconditionally, and it can even be done during armed conflict. It doesn't have to wait for a peace agreement like the adult DDR process, where you must have an agreement in place. The second distinctive feature of DDR, and I think this has been pointed out by a couple of speakers, is the broad definition that we adopt when we are talking about children who are involved in conflict. Because children are recruited in very many capacities as cooks, you know, porters, and just a whole variety, which has been discussed by other speakers. The adoption, definition that we use when dealing with children in DDR is all persons under 18 years of age who have been recruited or used by an armed force or group in any capacity. This will include, but is not limited to, fighters, cooks, porters, messengers, and spies. The most important aspect of this definition is that it includes children exploited for sexual purposes. And this is very important when it comes to girls, because from our experience in the field, many girls are abducted and used as sexual slaves or bushwives, wives of combatants. And if we use a narrow definition of DDR and say, where is your weapon, you know, where is your weapon so that you can get into the DDR process, then all these girls will not benefit from reintegration programs. Other distinctive features of DDR are that the DDR of children, it promotes sustainable reintegration. It is very important when we are pushing for the DDR of children to ensure that the children are fully reintegrated or fully transitioned successfully into civilian life. It's not like DDR of adults where you can give them a way of earning money and say, now you can transition into civilian life. Because what we have seen is that when reintegration of children fails, either if they are rejected by the communities or if they don't find livelihoods or they are not able to regain their social lives because of trauma or many other factors, then there is a tendency for children to be re-recruited and even their vulnerability is enhanced. So reintegration is only achieved when the economic, social conditions, and the political conditions are in place for the children to maintain a livelihood of dignity, and that and they live, they are now considered to be secure. The fifth aspect of that is very distinctive is that when we talk of DDR of children, we are talking about children who've been formally or informally released. When we talk about formal release, it could be a condition where we have a military commander surrendering and coming with children, and we have a process where they are separated from adults. But what we have seen in the field is that many, many children leave armed groups informally. You have children who escape. You have others who are abandoned by their commanders, maybe because it's so evident that they are children, and there's such a growing understanding that it's not useful to have children, and it could even lead to recruitment. But there's also situations where you have children who don't want to be identified with the formal DDR processes. And this is particularly true in the case of girls. The formal identification of a girl as a child soldier could actually just enhance their stigma and result in their exclusion from society. And this has been seen in many, many, many contexts. We cannot overemphasize the special needs of girls in DDR processes. We cannot overemphasize the importance of to look at the specific needs of girls. Many of these girls sometimes have children. Sometimes they are passed off as wives of commanders. And sometimes, as I said, they are very stigmatized. And so DDR of children is very, very conscious about this particular aspect of DDR. Now we will look at what DPKO has been doing. And the engagement of DPKO on children in armed conflict has evolved very much in the last years. This evolution, last eight or so years, this evolution is tied to the growing understanding that the protection of children in conflict situations is not just a humanitarian concern. It is a serious peace and security concern. So the Security Council Resolution 1261 of 1999 provided the first link between children and peacekeeping. In this resolution, the Council undertook to give special attention to the protection and welfare of children when taking action at promoting international peace and security. Consequently, since 2001, the Security Council has been including specific provisions of child protection in peacekeeping mandates. At least 12 peacekeeping mandates have had specific provisions on child protection. DPKO's engagement on children and armed conflict and DDR of children is based on Security Council resolutions, six of these on children and armed conflict, as well as the specific provisions in each Security Council resolution that defines a specific peacekeeping mandate. And one of the most interesting developments within DPKO, in DPKO's engagement on children and armed conflict, is the deployment of a specialized capacity referred to as the Child Protection Advisor within peacekeeping missions. With largely driven by the advocacy of the Office of the SRSG and with the support of UNICEF, DPKO deployed the first Child Protection Advisor to Sierra Leone in 2001. And today we have at least 60, actually more than 60, child protection advisors in seven different missions. The work of these advisors is to mainstream child protection within the work of peacekeeping missions and to make sure that all actors in the mission have a child-conscious approach to their tasks. There are a couple of activities that DPKO has been engaged in to promote the protection of children in armed conflict and to facilitate children's DDR. And the first of these is training. Training on child rights is required for all military personnel, is actually required by the Security Council. And it is a key function of the CPA. It is conducted for all military and civilian personnel. And this rights awareness is very critical because military components of peacekeeping missions are deeply engaged in the overall DDR process. They do different things, carry out various tasks ranging from providing security to the DDR process, information gathering, and even providing logistical support. As the first point of contact with armed groups, the military have been critical in signaling the presence of children. They have assisted in the release of thousands of children from armed forces and groups. And a very interesting example that we received recently from DRC, where at least 15,000 children are estimated to have been released from armed groups in the last seven or so years, was a campaign that was launched by the mission, because it's still estimated that 10% of the 25,000 troops operating in the eastern region are children. And the mission was confronted with a problem of access, with military commanders who are hiding children, and a lot of problems in terms of accessing these children. They launched a campaign in which they engaged the military to be actively involved in the separation of children. And since January, at least 500 children have directly contacted the military components of MONUC. Through this process, they've been directed and separated from armed groups and helped by partners on the ground. DPKO and the Special Representative made a reference to the experience of Côte d'Ivoire. DPKO is deeply engaged also with entering into dialogue with parties to conflict for the release of children. And in the example of Côte d'Ivoire, the child protection section of the mission was involved in dialogue together with the UN country team and with UNICEF. And as a result of the establishment of action plans by all the groups, armed groups, at least 1,400 children were released, and 3,000 have since been reintegrated by UNICEF and partners. Oops. monitoring and reporting is a very, very important process, monitoring and reporting grave child rights violations, because it not only contributes to holding perpetrators of child rights violations accountable, but it is a very important tool to guide the response of actors on the ground. And CPAs have been playing a very critical role in monitoring and reporting child rights violations, including reporting on recruitment by and use of children by armed forces and groups. It's a core element of the work because DPKO does not implement any programs on the ground as such. Those programs are implemented by UNICEF and its partners. In DRC, the information gathered in monitoring and reporting was very useful in the prosecution of warlords for recruitment and use of child soldiers. And it was actually, it also contributed to the first national prosecution ever of a local commander for the use and recruitment of child soldiers. In very many contexts, DPKO is well placed to conduct political advocacy because it has a strong political mandate and does not have any risk of jeopardizing its programs on the ground. So we do not implement programs, but our work complements the work of other partners on the ground, operational partners like UNICEF, and who are constrained from engaging in overt political advocacy. At the moment, DPKO is in the process of developing a policy that would help us on child protection that will greatly enhance how we work on child protection in the field. It's hoped that this will really strengthen our capacity because we could learn from what we have done in the last 7 years in different missions and use that to inform our interventions in the future. I just wanted to show you a slide that reflects the very huge expansion of DPKO. And it is increasingly clear that peacekeeping forces are key agents in protection of children in armed conflict. As the capacity of peacekeeping operations is expanding rapidly, we have at least 20 DPKO-led operations, 17 of which are peacekeeping missions and 3 are special political missions. We have at least 100,000 personnel in the ground, over 70,000 of whom are military, and thousands of civilians and police. The goal and the ideal goal would be to mobilize these vast resources of DPKO in favor of children in armed conflict and to ensure that all these components in the department integrate child protection concerns in their policies, and that because I believe that this will greatly, greatly enhance our ability to contribute to the protection of children and to the end of the recruitment and use of child soldiers. So you have the figures there, and I will not go into that because my time is running out. I will just, in concluding, flag 3 of the issues that I consider to be very important, which would advance the engagement of DPKO and influence our ability to deliver for children in armed conflict. The first is the inclusion of clear provisions on DDR for children in peace agreements. If we have peace agreements that are clear, saying that children shall be released and state a clear time frame for their release, as well as the responsibility of different actors, then we can have a lot of results with regard to the DDR of children. The second point I'd like to raise is that robust peacekeeping mandates with specific provisions on children and armed conflicts are critical to our work. A very good example is the Darfur Resolution 1769 of 2007. It requests for the protection of children to be implemented in the Darfur Peace Agreement, for continued monitoring and reporting, and for dialogue with parties. That kind of mandate is what we need when we are doing child protection work in the field. And very, very lastly, the famous question of resources. I believe that specialized child protection capacities are key to DPKO's contribution on DDR. And whereas the Security Council has already expressed its intention to deploy child protection advisors in all political and peacekeeping missions, the deployment so far has been patchy. Out of these 20 missions, we are only present in 7. They are driven by resource constraints and a lot of discussion on a case-by-case basis. I believe that with the prevalent use of child soldiers in the field and with the problems of child protection for the children affected by armed conflict, resources for this work is critical for our engagement. Thank you.
Thanks very much. We'll now hear from Teresa Betancourt.
Different technology than I'm used to. Do you know how to get the next slides up?
Let me bring mine down. Is that yours?
Yeah. It's the old ads between the Mac and the PC. but I'm learning to use a Mac. So I'll be talking about psychosocial adjustment and community reintegration of former child soldiers and try to give to you my policy perspective, mainly grounded in a longitudinal research study that we've had going on in Sierra Leone since 2002, although I have to note I've also worked in northern Uganda for several years, including an intervention study in that setting. I wanted to also acknowledge that this is research that's funded by USIP as well as USAID and its DCOF program. Before I get into our study, I'm going to touch a bit on the previous research on the topic of reintegration and psychosocial adjustment, present to you some of the key findings of our research, and I've been asked to, in the discussion, touch on implications for intervention, research, and policy, particularly how child soldiers have been involved in DDRR assistance, types of services needed and not needed, role of the community service providers, donors, and others in the DDR process, and recommendations for improving assistance. Now, we've mentioned there are a number of very important international instruments to promote better protections and services for children affected by armed conflict. I find it very important to start with just reflecting on Article 39 of the UNCRC, that states' parties shall take all appropriate measures to promote physical and psychological recovery and social reintegration of a child victim of any form of neglect, exploitation, or abuse, including armed conflicts. Such recovery and reintegration shall take place in an environment which fosters the health, self-respect, and dignity of the child. So with that as our backdrop, how are we doing? Well, there is almost an explosion of research on this topic now. A recent JAMA publication included several studies touching on the issues of children involved in armed conflict and child soldiers. There are just a handful of longitudinal studies. I'm excited to hear of Dr. Shepler's work on this topic, too. Neil Boothby's work followed 39 boys from the Langaheni Rehabilitation Center in Mozambique. And our study is attempting to contribute to this field by also following girls and boys with a larger cohort of about 400 males and females, as well as a comparison group. Now, in entering into this literature, we reviewed a number of the studies available looking at determinants of psychosocial adjustment and social reintegration in former child soldiers. And this is a report that we produced in collaboration with Psychology Beyond Borders, and April Naturale is here today and has copies of the report. It's also available on their website. But when you look at determinants of psychosocial adjustment and social reintegration, you see the factors that matter are as follows: exposure to violence across the range of severity and duration, and this is when context really begins to matter. Method of joining the armed forces, we've had a lot of conversation about that. Roles within the fighting forces, length of time spent with fighting forces, family acceptance upon return, community acceptance and stigma upon return, opportunities for livelihoods and education, so the path that children are on, and also access to traditional approaches to healing and reintegration, gender, and also personal responsibilities upon return. Now, if you think about how these map out, we're really talking about an ecological approach to understanding outcomes in any one child, that outcomes of psychosocial adjustment and reintegration really are the result of a synergy of a number of different layers of child development and context. So you have to consider individual factors, individual exposure, gender, age. You have to understand what's going on at the level of the family, who's available to that child to provide them with guidance and help them navigate a new environment upon return. What's the level of community support? What are the resources available in the community? What opportunities are there for young people? And also societal attitudes, cultural attitudes in the political context about the conflict itself and reconciliation and healing. So this means that when we're thinking of an ecological framework, it's very important that interventions also are responsive to an ecological framework, are holistic and responsive to these complex stressors across different layers of a child's developmental ecology. So let's go now to the example of Sierra Leone. I won't spend too much time on the background. I think there are a number of people who've done tremendous work in this country and have touched on some of the dynamics, but this was a more than 10-year civil conflict involving large abduction of children into the Revolutionary United Front and other fighting forces, including the Civilian Defense Force, or involvement. Deliberate attempts, like we heard in the stories from northern Uganda, to sever ties between the young person and their family and community to exactly send that message that you cannot go home, don't try and escape. But nonetheless, after the peace accords, large groups of children did return to their communities, and that was the time at which we launched this research project. And this was a collaboration with the International Rescue Committee that at the time was running interim care centers, particularly in the Kono region of Sierra Leone. And the IRC's process for the ICCs is one that you see followed by many other NGOs, and the steps for a child returning from being with the fighting forces often look a bit like this. If they go through an ICC. There's a period of immediate care and support at these interim care centers, so they're addressing those basic needs, health, nutrition, shelter, beginning to get the child stable enough to engage them and develop trusting relationships so the child can open up and begin to tell their story. And then the process of child tracing, family tracing begins. So they interview and get in-depth information about where the child was from, who they were last with, where they're originally from, what region, and also their attitudes about returning home. Then social workers are sent to the community to do a parallel process, to go out and find people within that community, even the individuals named by the child, to see who may be around, what their willingness is to welcome that child home. And a very important process also initiated by NGOs and local partners were community sensitization campaigns. And we see in our data this being very important, and community members and children speaking about the importance of these discussions that were opened up at the community level about the fact that these children had been found and there was the potential for them to return home, and to open up people's concerns, fears, attitudes, and to start that conversation. And also as a way of testing out, is this community ready to accept these children back? And then a determination was made about placement and what was in the best interest of the child and the child's return to the community. And then there's often a package of support services, maybe a period of support for school fees, job skills training, mentorship programs, apprenticeship programs, and then mechanisms put into place such as child welfare committees or local monitoring mechanisms to follow up children over time. And that's where it then began to get a little more fuzzy, like how long do these monitoring mechanisms really stay in place?
Oops.
So our research was designed to identify risk and protective factors in children's psychosocial adjustment and community reintegration with the intention of informing policy and programming. Our design was a mixed methods design, so this means we're engaged in in-depth qualitative interviewing, focus groups, key informant interviews with select groups of children, as well as a survey, which we added measures that were developmentally relevant to where the cohort was. They were 11 to 18 when we first began and are now 18 to 24 as we've come and followed them up in the third wave. So we have right now wave one collected in 2002, wave two, 2004, and we just completed data collection this last July of our data from 2008. So I don't have the findings yet of that, but I can speak between the first two waves. Our sample, the core to our sample, is this cohort of former child soldiers, 266 of them, girls and boys, about 12% girls, who passed through the IRC interim care centers and were resettled in about five different regions of Sierra Leone. At that time, we also randomly sampled from those communities of resettlement a comparison group of boys and girls of similar age and gender to look at the situation of generally war-affected children. And then in 2004, at wave two, we also added a cohort of young people who spontaneously reintegrated, which means that they found their way home without going through any formal interim care centers. And we worked with NGOs that were doing outreach to try and serve these. And this was mainly in the McKinney region of Sierra Leone. So just to give you a snapshot of our sample, this is a cohort of youth whose average age of abduction was about 10 years. Average length of time with fighting forces was anywhere from 2 to 5 years. You see a large proportion of these young people, as has been discussed, reporting being forced to use drugs and alcohol to get them involved in atrocity. Also, we did observe in some of the initial analyses we did looking at the large proportion of girls in the sample, comparing boys and girls, that we do see, again, this pattern of compounded adversity in the females, that they are exposed to many of the same exposures to violence related to war that you see in the boys, including frontline fighting, at rates comparable to males. But then when you look at sexual violence, it's happening in boys and girls, about 40% in boys, 9% in girls, but it's off the chart, of course, really characterizing the experience of girls. In terms of when they return home, what we see is girls also face greater stigma from the community and lower access to education and higher levels of most psychosocial problems. So we see, again, this picture of compounded adversity in the females, but very difficult circumstances for many of the youth. Now, when we talk about how youth fare over time, looking between wave one of our study and wave two, what we see is that, in general, you see a lot of comparable rates of psychosocial problems in the general war-affected population and former child soldiers. So that's important to note, that the war, again, affected so many young people that you see comparable rates in some of these outcomes. But there are subgroups who are on different trends within the sample. And in our sample, we found that young people who had perpetrated killing or experienced rape demonstrated higher levels of depression, anxiety, and hostility over time. And as you can imagine, these sorts of exposures tend to cluster in former child soldiers, although all war-affected children are certainly at risk. We also looked at some protective factors in our study and found that family acceptance can help mitigate some of the adverse consequences of war, particularly when you look at outcomes such as hostility. But in certain cases, such as being forced to kill other people, there are few protective factors that can touch that experience. And for children like that, there may be other forms of supports that are necessary. We also saw a very interesting dynamic in that we looked at community acceptance at two points in time. We looked at it at time one, time two. And we saw that in communities where acceptance was improving over time, so people in the community were making an effort, we also saw that former child soldiers show increases in pro-social attitudes and efforts, showing that they meet that effort in their own way and try to do better, become more helpful citizens in the community, which I think is extremely important when we talk about the capacity of youth. And again, there's been a lot of debate about labeling and should services be targeted just at former child soldiers or at the general community. I think you see here a picture of risk for all youth. But again, there is this problem of the likely concentration of the most serious risk factors in former child soldiers. And this points to the need to have mechanisms in place to provide long-term monitoring and follow-up for those who continue to show persistent problems. And we have to be able to capture that. It doesn't mean that everyone's going to have it, but when it does happen, we want to be able to identify these problems. So what does Sierra Leone look like at present? So this is some data that's just very initial data that we did when I was there in July. And what I wanted to show you was the findings of what we call a free list data collection technique, where we go to young people, girls and boys, and this is 86 youth in the streets of Freetown reporting on this, and we ask them just an open-ended question: what are the problems of war-affected youth in this community? And these are the sorts of answers they give, and we've now clustered these by theme and are showing you percents. So you see this mixing of the social and economic conditions of youth along with the psychosocial. So young people talk about there being no work, no food, no school fees, no shelter, the suffering of day-to-day life in terms of poverty, no access to medical care, no water supply. And then you also see them talking about problems of thinking, feeling, and relationship in the youth, kids getting involved in stealing, prostitution, particularly in the girls, as a survival strategy to make money, having no one to care for you, having lost your parents, fighting, getting involved in pregnancy at an early age, taking drugs, and smoking marijuana. So we actually use some of these terms for the problems of thinking, feeling, and relationship. Now, I'm showing you English, but we did this work in Creole. And we would take those terms for kids who fight, who have the problems of getting involved in prostitution, for kids who've lost parents. Tell me more about a child like that. And through drawing out through in-depth interviews, we arrive at these local terms that people use to describe kids who have this constellation of problems. And I wanted to share with you three of these. First of them, poil ot, which was described as a young person who is thought to have poil ot is someone who is always sad, can beat or hit people the slightest provocation, easy to anger. They've lost interest in so many things in life, think too much, full of worries, feel that things are finished for them in this life, and think of killing themselves. I'm just pulling out some of these key indicators that local people talk about. Toment was described locally as a constellation of problems of kids that's more characterized by this anxiety and some of what you would almost call traumatic stress reactions, always worried or nervous, confused, mixed up, feeling guilty, feeling regret inside. I think we've talked about that as a part of something that needs to be engaged with in the therapeutic process. Doesn't speak to others, withdraws, has nightmares, feels that people are out to get them or after them. And then a more serious problem that was described as more rare is the problem of frustrate. And these are young people who are showing very limited, almost reality testing, problems of reality testing, talking to themselves, behaving like someone who's out of their senses, again, feeling bad, having lost hope, quarreling, talking a lot without making sense, and not taking good care of themselves, thinking of doing bad to themselves and to others. So in our sample, with these indicators, we actually asked about in our cohort of youth, do you think you have the following poil-ot as described by, and these are the endorsements you see, 38% of our sample endorsing poil-ot, 30% toment, and 5% frustrate the more serious. I have to also note that 5% of the young people in our sample actually expressed either a past history of making a suicide attempt or active suicidal ideation that we had to do a lot of follow-up on. The important message of this, in Sierra Leone at least, is that there are evidence-based models of care. And one of our primary partners in responding to these risk of harm cases is a group called Community Association for Psychosocial Services, or CAPS. And they're trained by one of the premier torture treatment centers in the world, the Minnesota-based Center for Victims of Torture. But they're local people who've also integrated indigenous and traditional approaches to healing into the group work they do with young people. About you go to the capital Freetown and talk to the Ministry of Health or people charged with mental health about what models are in place, and they have one psychiatrist and they don't know about programs like this. So there's a big disconnect in that we do have knowledge out there, but it's not coming to scale to help the kids who need it most. And so I guess my take-home point here is that war-affected youth may require additional supports to benefit from the opportunities given to them, even in development programs. And as young people in the focus groups we did this summer talked about, it's something people will never forget about us. And I thought this story of this young girl is very exemplary of the sort of process you see young people proceeding through. She's talking about when she first returned home. My family treated me nicely, but I had no respect for elders. I later changed my attitude. It was because they encouraged me and told me I'll go to school again. That is why I changed. At first, I was disrespectful to my teachers. My mother used to go to school and talk to the teacher and explain my situation. Now, this is a young girl who had someone to help her navigate that changed environment post-conflict. This is a focus group of former RUF males. When I came back, they asked me what I wanted to do. I told them I want to go back to school. I was able to go back to school and had a very good result. And when we asked them about the things that matter for kids who do better after coming out of a process, an experience like this, they told us it depends on the way your family takes care and encourages you. Some really don't have people to encourage them to do something. The quality needed is to get good support to move on and someone who will tell you what is good and what is bad. So to summarize, many former child soldiers can lead productive lives following horrendous experiences, but we have to acknowledge that there are subgroups who continue to struggle with persistent problems over time. And the resilience of youth, the power of community, is no excuse for inaction or inattention to quality and sustainable services and supports for war-affected children and families. And I have just a few recommendations I want to summarize. I think the key words here are implementation, integration, and sustainability. Donors in the international community can adequately fund and provide technical assistance to develop sustainable systems of social protection, health and mental health care, and child protection. Education and employment initiatives can integrate psychosocial supports and screening mechanisms to find those kids who aren't able to benefit fully from opportunities like job skills training and school because of problems with family placement or substance abuse. We have to address various participation, such as girl mothers who have child care responsibilities. Health systems can scale up successful models like the CAPS program, integrate traditional and community-based approaches to child protection and care. And what's not needed in the new system are disorganized efforts or parallel systems disjointed from local governments. So we're really proposing a new paradigm of response to former child soldiers, one that moves from the short-term cycle of humanitarian response to thinking about systems of care that can sustain over time and continue to monitor and find these kids who are at risk of falling through the cracks and truly realize Article 39 of the CRC. Thank you.
Thanks, Teresa. I'm now going to turn it over to Bernard Harborn.
Thanks very much, Daruna. I must start with a disclaimer. The problem about having lead in your professional title is that you tend to jump around. So as Daruna knows, I'll be here talking about Zimbabwe or Cote d'Ivoire and then child soldiers. So I'm not the genuine article in terms of a child DDR expert. We do employ one in our program, and she's currently on duty in Brazzaville on mission there. But needless to say, what I hope I can do is fall somewhere between Anne and Teresa's presentations in terms of telling you a little about what the bank does and the kind of issues that we've experienced vis-a-vis child demobilization. Just a little brief general expose on what the bank does in DDR, because I know quite a few people are quite surprised that we get involved in these kinds of programs. Then I will focus on some findings similar to the kind of work that Teresa has done on Burundi and northern Uganda with LRA reporters to the Amnesty Commission, and then wrap up with some sort of general findings, if you will, and particularly with a focus on monitoring and evaluation of these kind of programs. So since the early 90s, really, the bank has been engaged in financing demobilization and reintegration programs, and we've financed over 25 country programs in the last 10 years. And really, governments have come to us for a number of reasons. Firstly, because they've been involved in substantial military downsizing, particularly after liberation movements, for example, in Ethiopia and Uganda. So it's part of an overall fiscal stabilization program. Secondly, they come to the bank. Why? Because we have the money, a lot of it. So international development assistance grants has provided a lot of finance for these DDR programs. And thirdly, because of our convening power, our ability to leverage others, particularly the donor community. And then picking up on that experience in the 90s, we established with 14 bilateral donor partners the largest DDR program of its kind in the world at the moment in 2002, and that's called the MDRP, the Multi-Country Demobilization and Reintegration Program, with a focus on the Great Lakes. Really came out of the in quotes, world war, if you will, centered in the late 90s in former Zaire. And that was focused on seven countries: Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, Central African Republic, Congo-Brazza, Congo-Kinshasa, and Angola. And it had financing of over $500 million of trust funds and IDA grants. And that's a program that I currently manage. And that has focused on three types of activity: supporting governments in what we call single country national programs. Secondly, providing special projects, that's financing for special activities, and this has been a particularly important window for financing child demobilization. And thirdly, providing technical expertise. So we have a staff of about 25 based in DC and in the field, and they support particularly governments, government institutions who are charged with DDR to implement these programs. And so that was established in 2002 and is now due to close in June 2009. To date, I'll throw a few figures out there. Obviously, there's a lot more, as Teresa has very eloquently described. There's a lot more behind the figures themselves, but figures do tell a bit of a story. We've demobilized something like 280,000 ex-combatants in the Great Lakes region, including over 30,000 child soldiers in the Congo, DRC alone. We have given cash reinsertion support to about 245,000 ex-combatants, and we have provided training and reintegration support to something like 220,000 of that larger figure. And finally, we provided specialized support to some 10,500 disabled ex-combatants. So how do we kind of really know what's happening at the more micro level? There can be a lot of discussion at the more strategic political level about the impact of such a massive program in terms of pushing the Great Lakes region to some kind of stability and consolidation of peace. But I think the objective today is to look more at the individual and particularly the child. And we've done this through a number of qualitative and quantitative techniques. And I'll just focus on two which have arisen from beneficiary surveys. The first is in Burundi, where we did a quantitative survey of something like 300 male and female children. Interesting about that is it brings out the kind of variables that Teresa touched upon. For example, one in four of them were head of households. So we always think child, needs protection, very, very young. But in fact, that child could be head of a household himself or herself. 80 to 90% had very good family relations. 60% had very good community relations. So overall, 7 in 10 7 out of 10 felt safe in their community. Therefore, the degree of social protection was very high, which belied the image of child soldiers being the reprobates, the delinquents, the bandits, the prostitutes that terrorized the local village, which was a kind of common perception amongst many Burundians. But when you narrowed it down, asking the community how were their relationships with a particular child, then this more robust picture came out. What was also very, very important, clearly, which struck us, was the importance of income generation and some kind of economic support. And 75% respondents expressed satisfaction with the kind of activities that we were supporting in terms of animal husbandry, bicycle taxis, petty trade, that kind of thing. And 80% had used whatever support that they had received in terms of plowing into an income-generating activity as opposed to, for example, meeting emergency health needs. So in sum, the work from Burundi told us, right, target assistance does reduce the vulnerability of child soldiers, that former child soldiers and their civilian peers shared the same kind of welfare concerns around health, education. And thirdly, again, came out in that Sierra Leone presentation, that there are so many variables which affect reintegration, ranging from your time in the force, age, and gender. I'll return to those variables in a minute. In terms of the LRA work, it was much more comprehensive, looking at something like 2,000 beneficiaries. And interestingly, they're very, very different kind of civil wars, you know, where you had something like 99.8% were abducted by the LRA. So clearly that has a huge impact in terms of their return into the community, vis-a-vis, for example, something like the FNL in Burundi, where it was very much a force that kids and adults joined in terms of dissatisfaction with the government in Bujumbura. There again, huge gender variances. 2/3 of girls were under the age of 14. 1/3 of boys were under the age of 14. Over 50% of girls spent more than 4 years in the LRA, clearly primarily as so-called bushwives, and more than 2/3 of girls were sexually abused. So again, a very, very particular caseload there vis-a-vis the LRA. 9 out of 10 lived at home on return and expressed a whole variety of indicators which indicated good social reintegration. Things like very strong friendships. 80% said that the local community had helped them out in some way or form, and 40% had engaged in an activity benefiting the community. And so 2/3 felt safe in their community. That their biggest fear, remaining residual fear, was clearly reabduction by the LRA. In terms of socioeconomic support, something like 50% of boys and 80% of girls had not completed their primary education, but that was very similar to most kids in that part of Uganda. 80% saw education as a priority. And interestingly, 50% of boys were continuing that as their primary activity. The big problem in North Uganda is the economy, and so only 1 in 20 was employed in some form. And 40% of male kids were involved in some sort of defense or security activity. Shows, okay, they've stepped out of the LRA rebel movement, but how are they best employed? Is in some sort of security form. And 9 out of 10 who were unemployed and never worked. So some interesting findings there. I'm going to just make about eight general points vis-a-vis this work on the Great Lakes and generally what we find. I think the first point may sound a little controversial, but I think there can be a trade-off, there can be a contradiction between child-centered approaches and security approaches. DDR is essentially a security-aimed program and not a protection one. And if you look at the kind of evidence that's coming out of Liberia, where over 100,000 people went through the DDR program, and yet we know from intelligence barely 1,000 people were involved in the fighting in the last days in Monrovia, you have to think, okay, what was all that money used for in terms of security objectives? And so the whole child and woman associated with armed forces has become a bit of a Trojan horse for a social welfare program. And clearly, the fact that there aren't good protection programs out there means that there's a huge burden on DDR programs. And I think that we have to ask ourselves, what are the primary objectives of DDR? That's the first point. I think the second point is that there's clearly a problem with very child-centered, protection-oriented programs when a lot of these children are not children. They may be fathers, they may be mothers. In one program in Congo Brazza, 80% of children had reached the age of majority during the lifetime of the project. So there's that large cohort between 15 and 18 years of age that are not the kind of children where you really need the kind of protection measures that we often talk about. And they can be in that gray area where they're not treated as adults and therefore they lose out and they're not young children in need of protection. And then thirdly, I think the child-centered approach, there's obviously a lot of focus on what I would call upstream activities in terms of advocacy, release, recruitment, protection, tracing and reunification. And then what gets forgotten is the really important stuff in reintegration in terms of economic support. And yet, commonly when you speak to kids, particularly the older cohorts, that's the kind of thing that they really need. Another general finding, again highlighted by Teresa, is the incredible complication by the number of variables which are involved. In terms of gender, duration in the forces, type of combat experience, age, health status, level of education. And so you have to have an incredibly sophisticated program to meet and contend with all those variables. And that's not necessarily a static view. That changes over time. I think last couple of points is that for programs to really work, there has to be what we call a quartet of decision-making, which is essentially the individual, the family, the community, and the outside actor, whether it's an NGO or a social worker. And often what you find is that quartet, that platform, is missing. And then last but not least, in terms of general findings, DAI did a evaluation of our work in DRC. And one of the key findings there was essentially because we'd focused on national ownership, in other words, it's the government's responsibility, which, as we heard from the last section, session, that human rights states obviously accountable in terms of human rights accountability. But their capacity to implement is obviously very weak in a post-war period. And so child protection had fallen between the cracks, between the national actor, UNICEF, and ourselves. And I think that can be a common problem where essentially you're asking for governments to take on these responsibilities very early, despite their legal responsibilities. Okay, so those are some general findings. I'll just wrap up for you in terms of some points about monitoring and evaluation, because clearly monitoring and evaluation is the key tool during the lifetime of a project to contend with all the kind of the issues that I've just raised and respond effectively during the lifetime of a project. I think what's interesting now, having Teresa here, is that I think there's an ongoing debate, which is just emerging really, between practitioners and academics. On monitoring and evaluation. And what you have is you have an increasing use of quantitative work. Jeremy Weinstein's work in Sierra Leone, the kind of studies that you highlighted there. And then practitioners, i.e. people who have an operation on the ground, getting very, very wary of that kind of work. Why? Because it takes time, it's complicated, it interferes with with working with children or ex-combatants, and it's very, very, very tough. And so it may be easier to say to the academics, right, you go off and do your studies on your own or in a few years' time, my focus is the operation. And yet clearly the what we suffer on that is that we don't have that very hard quantitative and qualitative data that can help us in terms of our program. So that's a kind of ongoing debate, if you will. And for example, academics, they'll want sufficient size, they'll want some kind of control group and randomization. Control group, so we're going to say to some kids, okay, you're not going to get your benefits for 2 or 3 years, if at all, because we want to see how you're going to get on in life, as opposed to the other kids, okay, you can receive your benefits. So those are some of the kind of difficulties that we're facing right now. There is a move to try and get more impact real-time assessment in projects. And it can be easier where you have interruptions. For example, in Sierra Leone, DDR started, then the RUF reinvaded Freetown. So you had a caseload in the early days of the post-conflict intervention, which you could return to in terms of evaluating. Or, for example, in DRC, some of these programs take a long time. And therefore, reintegration, you can see in the differences in out years. Kind of indicators, I think, are pretty obvious and should be kept as simple as possible. Clearly, some kind of employment, even for children, is key in looking at their economic reintegration. And then in terms of social, in terms of their activity vis-a-vis the community and their definition of a household. Does that include biological family members, for example? Voila. Yeah, thanks very much.
Okay. Thanks, Bernard. Finally, we will... Finally, we'll hear from John Williamson, who will try to put it in some perspective for us. Thanks.
Yes, I guess I also need to begin with a disclaimer. I am here on behalf of USAID's Displaced Children and Orphans Fund, but the buck stops here. I have to assume responsibility for what I say. Don't blame USAID or DCOF. DCOF does have some experience with the whole issue of demobilization of child soldiers. Going back to the situation in Mozambique, fairly extensive experience in Sierra Leone. We're a major funder of DDR for children there and are supporting Teresa's ongoing research. In Liberia, Uganda, DRC, and more recently in Colombia. My own experiences doesn't cover that breadth, but DCOF has some background in those. We were challenged this morning with going more deeply into issues related to child soldiers. And I want to try to push things even further. But I think Bernard has raised some very interesting, very challenging points. But I want to just make a few observations, which I hope panel members may wish to respond to or other participants. Well, going back to Susan's comment in the first panel, context matters so much. There clearly is no one paradigm, I think, for how to implement a DDRR process. It has to be tailored very much to a given context, the motivations that were involved, the way kids are going to be received in their communities. Are they seen as heroes? Or are they seen as villains? Have they perpetrated violence against their own communities? Major implications for the process itself. We do have a growing body of experience, some research and a lot of just experience with programming that's helping to inform future DDR processes. Bernard said that DDRR is fundamentally a security exercise. I would suggest that it is in the eye of the beholder. Certainly that's an essential element of a DDR process. I think, seen behalf of the international community and society, it's bringing an end to the conflict, getting the weapons out of the hands of those who have carried out the conflict and moving on. So clearly it is that. But I think framing it from the perspective of the participants and children in particular, I would suggest that perhaps the most meaningful way to frame a DDR process is one of identity transformation. That you had a certain identity before the conflict. You may have been abducted. You may have, with some degree of volition, decided to participate, and you became a member of a group. You may have been instrumentalized into that group, as Ricky Anwar Richard was saying earlier, or you may have done with some degree of volition, but you saw yourself as a part of that group. But the DDR is a transition to going back into becoming, again, a member of a family, a member of a community. And I think what we do has to facilitate that process. DDR, particularly the second D, I suppose, is also an eligibility determination process. You referred to situation in Liberia where there were vast numbers of people that showed up to be demobilized. Major implications in terms of the consumption of resources that might have otherwise gone into reintegration support. There's this crucial process of determining, is this person who's coming forward for the process, is this child, are they a child? Were they really a child soldier, or are they someone that was a relative of the commander that's been brought forward so they can benefit from some type of assistance? So I think it's worth maybe commenting on thinking about that aspect of eligibility determination. Thinking about Teresa's comments, I see some inherent dilemmas. Teresa's research is showing there are some long-term consequences of having been a child soldier and the kind of experiences you've had. We've also heard from the Sway research in Liberia that using status as a former child soldier as a targeting criteria for assistance can become counterproductive over time, that the issue is responding to the needs in the community and the needs of children, former child soldiers and others, recognizing that former child soldiers may have had some particular experiences and may have, as a consequence, have some particular needs. I think there's some inherent dilemmas there that might be worth commenting on. So those are just some issues that I wanted to raise. Mm-hmm. I maybe first give other panel members a chance to comment on those, and then we can open things up for broader discussion.
Sure. I think you raise a really important point, John, about the inherent dilemmas in services provision, and particularly the R parts of DDRR. And I agree wholeheartedly with the Sway research from Uganda and their work there about the dangers of labeling and giving assistance. It's the same issue now in Sierra Leone with gender-based violence. There's been tremendous, like almost a backlash of funding for improved responses to gender-based violence, but that's all there is. So, like, we'd have these suicidal boys, and if they were a suicidal girl and we could find out that they had a, you know, sexual violence history, we could get them services. But if they were a suicidal boy, they didn't fit one of these sort of specifically designed programs. So we've got a problem when we start to distribute services by labels. And that's why I emphasize in my presentation the challenge that's before all of us as a policy community to develop systems of care for all children, for all vulnerable children. And that means putting into place mechanisms to identify who's showing persistent problems. And it may be that you've got persistent problems because you witnessed your parents killed in front of you, or you may have persistent problems because you were forced to kill people. But we have to find the ways to find those people who continue to suffer and show distress and impairment. And without a system in place that can have mechanisms to do that kind of monitoring and case finding, we're going to be very limited in our ability to reach those who need it most and direct resources at those who need it most.
Okay. Well, thank you, John. We have about 15 minutes for questions. So I want to make sure we all get out of here on time and have lunch. So if you could just keep to questions. That would be appreciated. We'll start here.
Thank you. I have a couple questions for Teresa. I hope it's not too Sierra Leone specific for people. But my number one question, having been in Sierra Leone recently, I see that a lot of bad behavior by young people is described as sort of rebel behavior. Mm-hmm. Whether or not those children were rebels or not, it's kind of understood to be. So there are these stereotypes in Sierra Leonean society about what happens to former rebels. And from Bernard's presentation, we see that sometimes when people may have stereotypes about, broadly speaking, the population of child soldiers, but when asked about individual soldiers, former soldiers, say, oh, that one is doing very well. Mm-hmm. And so my question is really about how you can take apart the stereotypes about child soldiers, former child soldiers that people have, mm-hmm. and the actual experiences of people. Mm-hmm. So I think I got from your presentation that you asked people what are some of the problems of war-affected youth. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me people would have a ready supply of stereotypes at hand to answer mm-hmm. that question. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to find out a little bit more about how you moved from the stereotype level to the mm-hmm. the real experience level. That's number one. And then number two, Bernard was talking about how could we have a control group? How could we say to somebody, wait 2 years and don't take any services? But in fact, we have a natural control group in the Sierra Leone case, mm-hmm. that of the spontaneous reintegrators, mm-hmm. those who did not receive mm-hmm. formal services. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that you interviewed a number of those, mm-hmm. but didn't mention anything about the outcomes for formal versus spontaneous reintegrators. So I wonder if you could comment on that as well. Yeah,
sure.
Thank you.
Great. Excellent questions. We actually had to navigate these issues of stigma and stereotypes a great deal in order to get good data, because we were interested in some of these local terms to describe problems that would apply to all kids. So specifically, we didn't ask, describe for us a child, former child soldier who's not doing well, because if you ask a question like that, it is immediately full of stereotypes. And when we tried to, even in our sample, look at interviewing former child soldiers and then just general war-affected youth, so that we had an adequate sample to look at what the responses were differed by those groups. When we asked, where can we find former child soldiers around here, they said, oh, if you want them, go to the wharfs. All the girls, all the prostitutes down there are former child soldiers. So you're encountering these stereotypes all the time. I do think that the finding in our data about the community acceptance and how that's met with pro-social effort on behalf of war-affected youth, and particularly the former child soldiers, when we looked at that in the analysis, is really important. And we see that in our qualitative data, too. When we talk about unpacking stereotypes and the agency of youth, that there you do see demonstrated when young people tell their stories that this is their way to combat it. When people find out, sometimes they do a lot of effort even moving away from, particularly the girls, from the places they originate from, because they don't want that label. But they do talk about, when people come to learn that you're a former child soldier, I made great efforts to show people that I wasn't going to hurt them, that I was a good person, that I intended well for others. And so there's a lot to be done, I think, in terms of just like the sensitization campaigns to involve youth and involve war-affected youth in constructive alternatives and getting those people involved in the community at level so that people can begin to have these encounters and not hold stereotypes. It's very hard it's easy to hold their stereotypes when you haven't really had those interactions with people, and it's through having these more positive interactions and seeing the sort of agency and positive effort on behalf of former child soldiers in Sierra Leone, there's a lot more that could happen to transform those attitudes. In terms of the spontaneously reintegrated sample, just like our general war-affected youth sample, we don't see a lot of differences. So between the kids who were sampled because they went through interim care centers and the kids who made their way home, when you just take those two groups as a variable and make comparisons, again, they look very similar. The war in Sierra Leone touched the lives of so many children that, again, these strict labels are difficult. It's when you look at certain constellation of issues, like gender is a huge predictor of increases in hostility over time, particularly if you're female and you experience rape and you killed people during the war, then now you've got a package of risk factors that really does begin to predict kids who are on a deterioration slope over time. So, again, these sort of rough labels I don't think are very productive. I think, you know, a real design that would look at the active ingredient of DDR wouldn't be the design we have because it's very weak by that point, you know. So spontaneously reintegrated kids found in 2004 compared to a sample of kids who went through interim care centers that now you're looking at their data several years out. I think it's just not the right design to make those comparisons. So I don't think we can say, well, DDR works or doesn't work based on our sample. In terms of the control group and ethical issues, the work that we did in northern Uganda was actually a randomized control trial for the treatment of depression in war-affected children. And I think there are designs, depending on the length of your intervention, that can either be natural experiments or can be very ethical if you use a waitlist control, which means you have to have the resources to provide the intervention to the control group once you learn what's most effective. In some cases, this can be the most ethical design because you don't even know if the thing you're doing is going to help. And then once you've now done the first part of the study, you found out what's most effective, you have to be able to then provide that to the people who allowed you this experimental design to be the waitlist control, but with the guarantee that those services will be given to the waitlist control and then also to an arm that's not found to be effective in any way. So I do think there are ways to bring more scientific rigor to what we do in terms of evaluation.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you very much. I am the ambassador of Burundi, and I'm very delighted to be here to share this experience. You have mentioned some success stories, but Burundi also can be mentioned as a success story, because of the success of our peace process. And I'm very pleased to tell you that the last rebel movement, Paripehutu FNL, now has joined the peace process. And the leader of this movement is now at home. And he meet with the president as a regular basis on twice a week to see how they can be also included in the institutions of Burundi. So this is very, very positive. And what I would like to say here as well is the success of the DDRR program with the support of the international community, and especially the UN agencies, but also especially the World Bank program. But what I wanted also to highlight here is that the demobilization was disarmament and demobilization was a success, but unfortunately, the reintegration was not a success. Because of what? Because a country which is emerging from conflict has a lot of needs and unfortunately doesn't have enough means. For instance, Burundi, now in education, we have the president have taken measures to free the elementary school, and there are a lot of pressure on the schools, on the school's equipment, the professors. The same in the health in the sector. We are building health centers, but we don't have nurses, we don't have equipment, we don't have doctors. So Burundi as a country, as a government, can't afford all these afford all these expenses. So What I wanted to highlight here and to advocate is that the international community could support as much as possible all these countries emerging from conflict, Sierra Leone, Cote d'Ivoire, Burundi, and others. Because if the international community doesn't do that, so we will go back to the war. In the last few weeks ago, I was talking with some NGOs here on a Great Lakes forum policy, and I said that Burundi can't be taken as alone individually. It has to be taken as a part of the sub-region. And this lead me to talk about the education. You do know that in the sub-region, they taught the genocide ideology. And those perpetrators of genocide ideology are still there. How in education could we help all these children who have taken part in the conflict when they go back home? You said that, they will find their family, they will find support from their family. But as you have mentioned, they feel like a part of a group, a member of a group. But if this group is not good, they will go back to the conflict. So what is the program of the international community to support those countries concerned to put in the scholar curricula positive values? How can you help them? And also what I would like to mention here is that there are still, even if we succeed the disarmament in our countries, there are a lot of small arms which are circulating in the sub-region. How to address this issue? We do know that there are programs, but I don't think that it is enough. Because if we succeed in Burundi, in Eastern Congo, you are following the informations, you see what is happening, they can be recruited again to go and serve in one and or another movement. How to solve the problem, to address the issue in the sub-region again? This is what I wanted to highlight here. I am very happy that now Burundi has joined the East African community and that we are trying to solve the problem all together, but also through the Tripartite Plus Commission, which is facilitating by the U.S. government, and we are very, very happy for that. But I wish also, finally, to highlight the economic dimension. And I'm very happy that Bernard Harbour, the representative of the World Bank, has also mentioned that issue of the economic issue. If we don't develop project which can give also incomes, generate incomes to the community, again, the children will go back to the conflict. And we see that in Burundi, there are some who are involved in crimes, who are bandits, because they don't have incomes. So how can you develop also a project which can involve former combatants, but also the rest of the entire community? Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm not sure if anyone on the panel wants to comment before we go to our last question?
In the wrap-up.
Yes.
In the wrap-up.
In the wrap-up? Okay. Go ahead, then.
Thanks, Dorina. I'm Sandra Malone. I'm the Vice President of Search for Common Ground. We have been acting as the Secretariat for the Child Soldiers Initiative for the last year and a half. And one of the things you said, Madame Macomé, really got my attention. You were mentioning that it's important from the get-go to be able to integrate in peacekeeping missions mandates the issue of child soldiers, the issues surrounding child soldiers in a more effective, holistic way from the beginning. And I'm just wondering, particularly for us who are based in Washington, we're not particularly New York savvy, and I'm just wondering your thoughts on how one can best pressure DPKO and all of the actors who feed into DPKO in order to make that something that's possible in a world where there are 5 jillion priorities for peacekeeping missions. And we've been thinking, of course, for quite a while, as have you, that really that is one of the leverage points to affect real change in theater, if you will, in reality. So just wondering your thoughts on how to do that best.
Yeah, I gave the example of the Darfur mandate, the UNAMID mandate, which is very, very specific on what needs to be done. And increasingly, we are seeing the Security Council coming up with very specific references, for example, to 1612, monitoring and reporting child rights violations as part of the peacekeeping mandate. So those kinds of references are very important because then they will drive the work of the peacekeeping mission in the field. And the pressure point really is the Security Council because the mandates of peacekeeping missions are discussed there. They're worked out there. And I think the idea is that when we look at a certain context, how we can influence, I think SRST's office is best placed to answer. I think that we will, our arguments would be the context of children within those particular conflicts that the peacekeeping mandate is being sent to. But definitely the advocacy is with the Security Council to say that this is something that really needs to be, you know, specifically mentioned and very strongly stated in the peacekeeping mandate, because then the resources that the peacekeeping missions will find through the Special Committee for Peacekeeping Operations will be driven by the mandate that is given to that peacekeeping mission.
Okay. Well, I think we're at the conclusion, but I wanted to give the panelists a chance to either address some of the points that the ambassador made or some other brief final comments. I don't know.
Okay, just some quick points. Mm-hmm. Eligibility, absolutely, that's key. It would be interesting if there were child protection programs, for example, out there that were offering $1,000 per child, what that would do to the DDR business. We currently estimate something like $1,100 to $1,200 per ex-combatant. So you can imagine what questions there would be and what opportunities there would be for child protection if there was that kind of resource on the table for proper child protection. First question. Second point, absolutely, the problem with reintegration is that if your economy is not bouncing, as it's not in the case of Burundi, then that means that employment, income generation is going to be that much more difficult, and therefore the risks, as the ambassador outlined, continue. Finally, what's interesting about the North Uganda case and this point about stigma and labeling is that on the MDRP side, the World Bank side, we don't provide economic reintegration support to the reporters coming back from the LRA. So that's very much a community-focused program, which means they're generally screwed vis-a-vis other kids and ex-combatants elsewhere in the region. But there is a degree of parity between them and the communities they're going back into. Thank you.
Great. Anybody else?
Well, just okay. One thing I'm trying to learn more about is the work of the Peacebuilding Commission and Peacebuilding Fund, particularly with Burundi and Sierra Leone being the focus of attention for those, and where within that spending has there been attention to youth and these sorts of targeted investments to stop or shore up against the risk of backsliding that the ambassador so eloquently described. And I don't know much about that. It does seem like, you know, that mechanism and Kofi Annan's sort of vision for that has great potential. But I've spent a lot of time trying to learn about its actual implementation and what that has shaped up to be. And would be interested if anyone else on the panel can speak to that. But I think when we talk about these two case examples, that's one idea of how to proceed differently.
Okay. Well, thank you.
It is time for lunch now. So if you go out here on the right, there are boxes, there are salads, and there are sandwiches.
Take them. Come back at 2 o'clock. You're welcome to stay here. Welcome to walk outside. Looks like it's a beautiful day. Get a little bit of exercise, but be back at 2 o'clock sharp. Thank you. Yeah.